Good morning, everyone. Thank you for that beautiful song, Swamiji's hymn of Samadhi, a song of Samadhi, very appropriate for today's topic. The topic this morning is Swamiji as poet. In April of this year, the Vedanta Society of Providence inaugurated a new addition to their center, and they invited many of the monks throughout the country, and they gave each one of us a particular topic to speak on, and this was the topic they gave me. And I think I had the best topic of all of them. When I heard it, I thought I was really lucky. It's such a nice, interesting topic to speak on. Swamiji as poet. Yeah. So it was only 10 minutes that we could speak on that occasion, but I thought I would take that and turn it into a regular Sunday talk. We know that Swamiji had a variety of different areas in which he excelled. We can even say in which he exhibited a certain type of genius. And Sri Ramakrishna never tired of telling everyone around, whoever would listen, about Swamiji's greatness when he was just a young schoolboy. Not an 18, 19 years old, just a college boy. Whoever was there, he would tell them, look at this young boy. And he would give different examples. He would say, others, they're like little pitchers and pots and mugs and things. He's like a huge container. And others are like little fish swimming around. He's a huge red-eyed carp, he used to say. And others may be little ponds and puddles and bodies of water. He's a big lake, like that. So he would praise Swamiji that way, even comparing him to Keshav Sen, who was world-renowned. He had met Queen Victoria. And he would say, if Keshav has one part of his knowledge and wisdom and power, then mine, Narendra, has 16 parts. That means 100%, like that. And Narendra Swamiji, of course, would be very embarrassed. He would say, what are you saying? The world-renowned man, I'm a simple schoolboy, but nothing would stop Thakur. And Thakur didn't even know about his genius in poetry at that time. Right? This is something that developed later. Of course, there was another member of the Brahmo Samaj who wasn't a bad poet either at that time. Yeah. And later he became a Nobel laureate even. And his 150th birthday was also celebrated recently. I think, what was his name? Huh? Rabindranath Tagore. Okay. Anyhow, Swamiji, he had a special way with words. And that was with regard to speaking, with regard to writing, compositions, all sorts of things. He was a brilliant orator, we know that. Just as a conversationalist, as a letter writer, giving formal public lectures, whatever it was, he would keep people spellbound because of the force of his personality, mostly. From his very first speech at the Parliament of Religions, he needed only 5 words, Sisters and Brothers of America, to capture the hearts of everyone. So this was something special with Swamiji. Was it Professor Wright who said he was an orator of divine right? So Swamiji had this ability. So it was simply with 5 words, a standing ovation from thousands of people there. And the interesting thing is that Swamiji had extreme stage fright, especially that first. He had never spoken in public before. And here there are thousands of people, and the best-known speakers from all the religions of the whole world sitting on the stage with him. So they asked him to speak, and each time he said, no, no, no. And then he got up his courage and prayed to Divine Mother, Mother Saraswati, to be with him. And then he gave his short speech, and it was the best speech of all of them, and just captured the hearts of all of his listeners there. Most of his lectures were delivered in English, and 2 reasons for that. One is that many of them were given in the West, the most important ones in the United States and in England. These 2. And even when he traveled through India, he spoke in English because this was the one language that everyone knew. He didn't know any of the South Indian languages. This was the language that was more or less common to people of India who spoke all different languages and dialects. Now, we're very fortunate that Swamiji had a young English disciple named J.J. Goodwin, who was an expert at shorthand. And he was extremely faithful to Swamiji. Wherever Swamiji went, he went. Whenever Swamiji spoke, he would write down in shorthand whatever Swamiji said, and later he would write it out. And this is how we have all of the lectures of Swamiji. Just as, because of him, we have all of the conversations of Sri Ramakrishna. Because of Goodwin and a couple of others. We know this, Ellen Waldo also, and some others, but mostly because of Goodwin. And we have all of Swamiji's lectures, and some of its most inspiring lectures. Of course, the ones in the West were very philosophical, very uplifting, trying to inspire everyone to realize the divinity within. But when he went to India, he was full of fire, not simply this idea of finding God within, but this idea of service. So it was always arise, awake, stop not till the goal is reached, but still don't forget about your fellow countrymen who are dying for a loaf of bread. So he tried to inspire the country to service as well. And he brought Goodman with him, who traveled around and heard these lectures and also recorded them. So this was the formal types of lectures that Swamiji gave. Then he also gave informal classes. These were probably even more interesting. And fortunately, we have, as I mentioned, this Miss Ellen Waldo, who was there at Thousand Island Park when Swamiji gave a whole series of classes throughout that summer, which we know as inspired talks. And this Miss Waldo, it's interesting, she was a relative descendant of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great transcendentalist. Yeah, so she had that in her blood. And Emerson and the transcendentalists, Emerson and who was the other one? Thoreau. Yeah, were very much inspired by Vedanta. And they knew about the Upanishads, and much of the transcendentalist movement can be traced back to Vedantic thought. So she herself said that there were times when Swamiji spoke that he lifted everyone to such a height that it was impossible even to record anything. So there are many things gaps, there are many things missing, probably the most important things, unfortunately, because she said that she would be awestruck just listening to Swamiji and forget to write things down. There were some who were so shaken, their old ways of thinking were practically destroyed, so shaken that there were days when they couldn't even come out of their room. This was the power of Swamiji's words. Then Swamiji as a writer, not yet his poetry, but just articles that he wrote. One of the things Swamiji wanted to start was a Bengali magazine, which we still know today as Udbodhan. And to get it started, he would from time to time write articles and send them back, sometimes light things even. There's one called Parivraja, where he talks about his travels and some very interesting things. He was on a boat near Egypt, and when they caught this big shark and everything. And interesting, when I studied Bengali in school, we read that. Not for any religious reasons or because it was Swami Vivekananda, but because it was groundbreaking in its style and content. Before that time, anyone who wrote in Bengali would write in the Shadubhasha, a very formal style, and Swamiji wrote in a very colloquial Yathotibhasha. He was considered to be really one of the groundbreakers and one of the pioneers of that new style of writing in Bengali. Then Swamiji was a tremendous letter writer. In those days, you didn't pick up the telephone, you didn't text people, right? You didn't send emails and everything. If you wanted to correspond, you did it in letters. So, and his letters, of course, were something that people would save. If you got a letter from Swami Vivekananda, you didn't throw it out. So most of these letters are available to us. They've been printed, of course, in the Complete Works. There's also one complete separate volume just dedicated to the letters of Swami Vivekananda. And here we see certain aspects of Swamiji's personality that we don't find in other places. We see that lightness and humor. We see him really bearing his soul when he wrote back, especially to his Western disciples and especially to the women, because he looked upon many of them as really his very closest supporters in this country. Some of them he addressed as mother, some as sister. He had a different relationship with all of them. So we find him expressing his deepest emotions to them. Then we have the letters that he wrote back to his brother disciples, Swami Brahmananda especially, Swami Akandananda, Swami Ramakrishnananda, these three especially, but usually addressed to all of the brothers, and also Alasinga, his lay disciple from Madras, whom he loved very much. These letters are again, full of this idea of service and sacrifice. So we find all of these different aspects of Swamiji's personality manifest in these different letters. And as I say, the letters that he wrote back to from India to his women disciples and devotees are really fascinating. Mary Hale and there were four, he called them the four sisters. They were two sets of cousins. He had such a close, sweet relationship with them because he stayed in the Hale family. That was in their house. That was the first place he stayed when he came to Chicago. A long story, but they found him just sitting on the curbside and invited him in, and he stayed with them. So he wrote to them like a loving brother. He wrote to Sister Nivedita like a chastising father very often. Yeah, because she needed sometimes to be pushed this way or that way, and he had great hopes for Nivedita. And it turned out that she did tremendous work in India for the education of the girls and women in India. And Sarah Bull and Mrs. Hale, to many of them, as I said, he was like a child, because he looked upon them as a mother. So we have all of these different types of literature, recorded conversations, lectures, letters, everything. But there was something very special about poetry, Swamiji's poetry. He loved to write poems. We could say it's almost like a hobby with him. And he would include them in letters. He would write them on special occasions. Sometimes they would be very lighthearted, sometimes very deep. Sometimes he would be inspired through some tremendous event. So all different occasions, all different types. We see some of his mystical experiences in these letters. We see very emotional highs and lows. And all of these things stand revealed to us in a way that we don't see anywhere else, really. Some things, and this is the beauty of poetry, some things can be expressed in poetry that can't be expressed otherwise. We heard this beautiful hymn of Samadhi. Now, this obviously is directly out of Swamiji's own experience. And the language is so beautiful. I was just... If we just look at some of the final lines of this hymn, very gradually, this world is like just different shadows, massive shadows. It just goes and merges into that Mahalaya, to that great void. And then, what's left? Only the stream, the steady flow of I, it flowing moment after moment. Then suddenly what happens, even that stream, it stops, and shunya malila. Then this the void merges in the void. Yeah, tremendously beautiful. And then Avang Manasa goes, what it is can't be expressed, it's beyond mind and speech. Who understands it in the heart? That's the only way to understand it. Who understands it in the very depth of one's being, then one can have some glimpse of what it means. So We have examples of poems that can express this state of samadhi in a way that he couldn't express even if we read Raja Yoga. To say that, yes, the mind becomes free from our vrittis and we go into a higher state, this gives us a much more beautiful picture of that state of samadhi. So Swamiji was clearly not a poet in the ordinary sense. He didn't sit down and simply say, well, today I have to write 5 poems, tomorrow I'll write 5, then I'll have a book. He didn't do anything like that. Sometimes his poems were included in his letters. If we read his letters, we'll find many of them were there to express some idea or even as a kind of gift to some of his disciples, sometimes for a birthday or some other occasion, or just to give a little special joy to them on that day, he would send a poem. We have one that's called Many Happy Returns. This was written to Alberta Sturgis. She was one of the 4 Hale girls on her 23rd birthday. Here's a small thing. He wrote a very similar thing to Sister Nivedita. The mother's heart, the hero's will, the softest flowers, sweetest feel, the charm and force that ever sway the altar's fires, flaming play, the strength that leads and love obeys, far-reaching dreams and patient ways, eternal faith in self, in all, the sight divine in great and small. All these and more than I could see, today may Mother grant to thee. Can you imagine getting a birthday present like that? Swamiji writes a poem. But there is there's a fascinating correspondence between Mary Hale and Swamiji, where she writes first a poem. She was a good poet herself. And then Swamiji replies with his own poem, and then she replies with another poem. This is Swamiji's response to her first poem. It's called Misunderstood. In days of yore on Ganga's shore preaching, a hoary priest was teaching how gods they came, as Sita, Ram, and gentle Sita pining, weeping. The sermon's end, they homeward wend their way, the hearers musing, thinking. When from the crowd a voice aloud this question asked, beseeching, seeking, Sir, tell me, pray, who were but they, these Sita Ram you were teaching, speaking? So, Mary Hale, allow me tell, you mar my doctrines, wronging, balking. I never taught such queer thought that all was God, unmeaning talking. But this I say, remember, pray, that God is true, all else is nothing. This world's a dream, though true it seem, the only truth is He, the living. The real me is none but He, and never, never matter changing. Whatever the occasion, whether it was a birthday, whether it was just a correspondence, we see that these ideas seem to flow spontaneously from Swamiji. So he was, we can say, an inspired type of poet. In fact, it seems that these ideas were so strong that they couldn't remain unspoken. Somehow they had to come out. Some were written as hymns and songs. And Swamiji, this was another area of genius that Swamiji, with music. He was a musician, we know, but also could write. And many of these he wrote not just the lyrics, but the tune for. And of course, we have our Kandana, we have our Om Hrim Ritam. This Kandana was written in a very classical Indian style called Dhrupad. I don't know anything about this, but those who know it say that it's a very high type of composition. And even when we hear it, we get that sense. And it, 3 different parts of it that have 3 different tunes and 3 different rhythms. And there's a certain majesty to the whole thing. Sometimes at Belarmut, on big occasions, when the temple is full, and they'll have the not only mridanga, but violin playing it, accompanying it. And you'll hear the hundreds of monks and devotees singing. It's just thrilling. The whole temple seems to vibrate with it. So this Kandana is a very wonderful composition. The music is very beautiful. It's interesting that the name of Sri Ramakrishna is not mentioned a single time in it. But we know it's about Thakur. And also, it's written in a particular style. It's Bengali, but there are only a few words that are really Bengali. Otherwise, he used all Sanskritized Bengali words that are common to almost every language. So almost anyone from any part of India will understand, if not the whole thing, then almost the whole thing, just because of the language that Swamiji used. There's one particular line that I'm very, very fond of. Swami Tathagatananji likes to quote this particular line also very much. This Sampada Tava Shri Pada Bhavagosh Pada Variyatai. It says that the holy feet of Sri Ramakrishna are the greatest treasure that we can imagine. That compared to that treasure, this world that we see is like the water and the mud puddle that's formed in the rainy season when the cow is walking in the mud and it leaves a little impression, that little bit of water that forms there, compared to the treasure of Sri Ramakrishna's holy feet, this world is like that little mud puddle. And his Om Hring Ritam and the Pranam Mantra at the very end are also very wonderful. There's a very nice story about the closing portion of that, Sthapakaya Dharmasya Sarva Dharma Swarupine, that portion. One of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples was Navagopal Ghosh, and his wife, Nistarani Devi, who was tremendously devoted to him. She was a wonderful, wonderful person. If you read about her life, it's very inspiring. Sometimes we think only the direct monastic disciples led inspiring lives, but she's someone that almost puts them to shame with her tremendous devotion. Just to give an illustration, when she became pregnant, she vowed that if the child were a boy, she would offer that to the service of Sri Ramakrishna. Then the child was born, and it was a son. They gave the son the name Nirod. And after a couple of weeks, when the child was old enough, she wrapped up the little infant in a sheet, and she went with her husband to Dakshineshwar, to Sri Ramakrishna. And Thakur saw she was holding something in her arms and said, "What is that?" He went into an ecstatic mood and said, "Well, what do you have there?" And this Nistarani Devi laid this infant child at the feet of Sri Ramakrishna and said, "I have brought you this offering." So Thakur looked at the infant boy for a few minutes and placed his hand on his head and blessed him. And he said, "Ah, what a nice child. You've offered it to me. Good. Take care of this child now, but know that he belongs to me. In due time, I will take him back." So this Nistarani Devi raised this boy, not as her own, as belonging to Sri Ramakrishna. As soon as he was old enough, he had the constant company of the monks of the order, especially Swami Brahmananda was very fond of him and took him on pilgrimage. There are very nice stories about that. Eventually, he joined and became a monk of the order, Swami Ambikananda, and he was known to have a beautiful singing voice. So Swami Brahmananda loved music. He always kept some monk with him who could sing these bhajans and everything. So he became an attendant of Swami Brahmananda and would sing for him all of the time, very much beloved in the order. So this was Nistarani Devi. She and her husband were inaugurating a shrine in their home to Sri Ramakrishna. They invited Swamiji and some of the other monks, and spontaneously, without thinking about it, just out of his emotion and inspiration, Swamiji composed that pranam mantra, Sthapakaya cha Dharmasya. Then, of course, we know that Swamiji composed many other hymns in Sanskrit and Bengali, and he translated some of the important Sanskrit hymns, things from the scriptures, as well. But there was a special class of poems, as I mentioned before, that we can say really stand apart as being inspired. That somehow Swamiji was overtaken with the mood, and almost as if by itself these poems came out of him. The term that we find most often used for a poet is kavi, in Bengali kavi. This kavi, it's a very interesting term because we find that it's used for a poet, but it's also one of the attributes, one of the characteristics, adjectives that we find used for Purusha that we find used for God. We have a beautiful verse in the Gita, chapter 8, verse 8. Kavim Puranam Anushasitaram Anur Aniyangsam Anusmaredya Sarvasya Dhataram Achintya Rupam Aditya Varnam Tamasah Parastat. This is part of two verses that explain how we should think of this Purusha at the time of death in order to become one, to merge, to attain to that Purusha. So this Purusha is, it's our Brahman, the same as our Brahman, Nirguna and Saguna. Brahman is the source of the universe. And the very first adjective that we have is Kavi, which is usually explained in terms of wisdom, seeing, Kranta Darshi, that someone who has seen everything that has come in the past, who knows everything in the future, so someone who is all-knowing, and someone who is a visionary, a seer, we can say like that. So this verse, these two verses, say one should remember, Anusmarad, one should meditate on that Kavi, on that wise, all-knowing, omniscient Purusha, the ancient one, Purana, the ruler, Anishasataram, smaller than an atom. That means subtler than the most subtle, the sustainer of all, of inconceivable form, self-luminous like the sun, and beyond all darkness, that means beyond all ignorance. Now, at the time of death, if we can think of this Purusha that way, and fix our prana within the space between the eyebrows, then we'll attain to that Purusha. So, the very first adjective we have here is Kavi. We find in the Isha Upanishad also that this description of this Brahman or this Purusha is Kavi, a kind of divine poet, we can say. It's not normally taken in that literal sense, but it's a very nice idea. I like to think of this Purusha as this Adi Kavi, as this primordial, ancient first poet. And this whole universe is the poem, this creation is the poem of that divine poet. We have so many different theories of creation in Vedanta, some of them highly philosophical, some of them very allegorical, some very devotional and dualistic. We find this funny combination of this highest philosophical interpretation and this allegorical type of interpretation in the Upanishads themselves, that we find that that Brahman, which has no senses, which has no organs or anything, looks around, and that Brahman, who has no desires or wants or anything, feels lonely, and that Brahman, who doesn't desire to do anything, thinks, "Let me become many," and through that process, this whole universe comes into being. Or we have this idea of Leela, that why did God create this universe? Just for fun, just out of sport, to enjoy it. Not that he was lonely necessarily, but to enjoy it. So we really don't know anything about this creation, why, but this is another very nice way of understanding creation, that here Purusha is thought of as this poet, and that this creation as a poem spontaneously flows from the mind of that divine poet. And what is Maya here? Maya is like the muse of poetry. We have this idea in Greek philosophy. There are different goddesses that are called muses. Each one will be a goddess of a different art. So a muse for music, for poetry, for literature, like that. And their job is to inspire someone so that that person will, this poem will come out of spontaneously out of that person. So we can look upon Maya as this cosmic muse of poetry, which inspires this divine poet to compose this poem of creation. And what is this poem? It's the creation itself. The idea that arises in the mind of the divine is what we think of as creation. Not that the Brahman first has a plan and says, "Well, let me do it this way and that way." And just to think it is for it to come into existence. So this whole universe is a type of poem that way. And we know that no poem can capture the beauty of nature and everything the way nature itself does. There's a very hokey poem about the trees, you know, that I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. It's that type of idea, that the reality itself is the most wonderful poem that we have. So this idea of the Purusha as a divine poet, and the idea that this creation is his master poem, somehow raises this type of mentality or thought or cosmic consciousness above that of the of the philosopher or the scientist or the mathematician, even on the human level. So we find that the poet creates in a different way, that the creation is something different. We have a sense that it transcends our ordinary way of thinking and seeing in the world. So we find that Swamiji himself, because the real poet is the one who emulates this divine poet, that Swamiji himself clearly composed some of his most powerful poems out of some type of cosmic inspiration, where his mind was raised to a different type of level, where his emotions became so increased that devotion was almost impossible to contain within himself. So almost to the point where we can't say whether the poem itself came out of that emotion or whether the writing of the poetry was the vehicle to take him to some higher state of ecstasy. Now, the best example I think that we have of this is Swamiji's poem, Kali the Mother. This was written when Swamiji was in Kashmir. It was a very, very emotional period in Swamiji's life. He had returned from the West. His health was practically broken. He brought some of his Western women disciples with him, some of the very closest ones, Sister Nivedita, Sarah Bull, Josephine McLeod. And there was one woman, Mrs. Patterson. She was the wife of the Consul General from the United States who was there. Anyhow, he felt a need to go off to some solitary place, so a pilgrimage was planned to go to Kashmir. This was in 1898. Swamiji had recently gotten the news of the death of Goodwin, who was so faithful to him, had followed him to India. It was a tremendous blow to Swamiji. And there were others also. I think that Raja of Khetri passed away before then. Anyhow, so it was a very, very emotional time for Swamiji. So they went on this pilgrimage. Even the company of these few devotees from the West proved tiresome for Swamiji. He would go off on his own. He was longing for solitude during this period. And the climax of this pilgrimage came, of course, when Swamiji went to the great cave shrine for Shiva in Amarnath. This is one of the great pilgrimages in India that thousands and thousands of people go, and they try to go at the same period. On the sacred day, the full moon. Full moon or new moon?
Just passed.
Usually it's July. Yeah.
That
big day. Anyhow, so Swamiji went like an ordinary pilgrim with all of the others, and when he went there, he had a tremendously high type of, intense type of experience. The others didn't go, but he allowed Sister Nivedita to go with him. He wanted to dedicate her to Shiva. So she was there and she recorded these different things. She wrote, "When Swamiji entered the cave and beheld the image of Lord Shiva, he practically swooned with emotion. A profound mystical experience came to him of which he never spoke, beyond saying that Shiva himself had appeared before him and that he," meaning Swamiji, "had been granted the grace of Amarnath, the Lord of Immortality, namely not to die until he himself chose to do so." So it was a tremendous experience. Just to give a little hint of how intense this experience was, later the doctor said after that his heart expanded at that time, and he suffered from that enlarged heart, and that he had a blood clot in his eye. So even the emotions were so strong that they manifested in a very intense physical way with Swamiji. Now, after this experience, Swamiji spoke nothing but words of Shiva and how Shiva was the ideal monk and how he would have this tremendous detachment and would go off into the cremation ground and wander there and sit in meditation, smear his body in ashes, and didn't want to have anyone else's company. So this mood was very, very strong with Swamiji. And then we don't know why, there's no explanation, but suddenly his devotion switched to Mother Kali. Now Kali, of course, is a consort of Shiva. Thinking of Shiva, probably he was thinking of Kali also. But Nivedita writes that after this, he constantly was singing the songs of Ram Prasad, and he felt that the Divine Mother was with him, that she was a living presence with him. Swamiji later told his brother disciples, "Wherever I turned, I was conscious of the presence of Mother, as if she were a person in the room, as if her hands clasped my own and led me about as if I were a child." So these were real experiences for Swamiji. But at the same time, see, this is the attitude that Thakur had of being a small child and the loving mother. At the same time, Swamiji saw the other side of Mother Kali, that she was the source of the terrible as well as the beautiful. That everything that we look upon as evil and destructive, this was also part of that divine Shakti. Everything came from Mother. So Swamiji had this very full, comprehensive view of Mother Kali. Now this mood became so strong that Swamiji had to go away alone and spend some time in solitude. They were still in Kashmir and the houseboat and everything, so he went by boat to a very solitary place. He was there all by himself. Only there was one Brahmo doctor who had met Swamiji, who became very attached to him, and this doctor would come and check on Swamiji every day to see that he had everything he needed and that his health was okay. Some days he would go there and Swamiji would be so absorbed that he wouldn't disturb him. He wouldn't even let him know that he had come. He would quietly go back. Now during this period, Swamiji was longing for some type of revelation, some type of direct experience of the Divine Mother, probably much the same as Thakur was longing for a vision of Mother at the Kali Temple at Dakshineshwar. And it came one evening. Swamiji later explained that he had fixed his whole attention on the dark, the painful, and the inscrutable in the world, with the determination to reach, by this particular road, the one behind the phenomena. And this, of course, was Swamiji's conception of the Divine Mother. And he said to Nivedita once, "Learn to see the Divine Mother in the terrible as well as in the beautiful." That was his advice to her. So that night, Swamiji became fully absorbed in this state. And in that state of absorption and inspiration, he wrote this poem, Kali the Mother. And after he wrote that poem, the pen fell from his hand, he dropped to the floor, and was lost in a state of bhava samadhi. Now, how he could write that poem, and do we have any other example of a mystical experience being captured by the individual in poetry at the very moment that he was having it? A tremendous experience and a tremendous boon that he wrote that poem. Let me read this, Kali the Mother. "The stars are blotted out. The clouds are covering clouds. It is darkness, vibrant, sonant. In the roaring, whirling wind are the souls of a million lunatics, just loose from the prison house, wrenching trees by the roots, sweeping all from the path. The sea has joined the fray and swirls up mountain waves to reach the pitchy sky, the flash of lurid light. Reveals on every side 1,000,000 shades of death begrimmed in black, scattering plagues and sorrows, dancing mad with joy. Come, Mother, come, for terror is thy name, death is in thy breath, and every shaking step destroys a world for'er. Thou time, the all-destroyer, come, O Mother, come, who dares misery love and hug the form of death, dance in destruction's dance, to him the mother comes." So it really is a tremendous thing that such an intense experience of such a very high nature was recorded in the form of a poem in a way that perhaps Swamiji couldn't have expressed any other way, this intense experience that he had. The only other example that we have perhaps of this is the Vedic rishis themselves. We often hear that the hymns of the Vedas are revealed scripture. Now, we don't know what that means exactly, but somehow the rishis must have gone into some state where they were inspired to compose these, or they heard them somehow, or they felt that these just spontaneously came out of them. Seeing this example of Swamiji composing this gives us some slight hint as to what perhaps is meant by the revealed scripture of Shruti, these hymns that the rishis themselves composed or heard or were inspired to come out with. So this was Swamiji, just as he had many facets to his life, many moods, many areas of genius. We also find all of these different types of poetry that Swamiji wrote, the light and humorous poems that he sent to Mary Hale and others, the Sanskrit hymns revealing his great devotion and wisdom, some of them, of course, like this hymn of Samadhi, revealing the very highest types of experiences of meditation and merging the mind in the absolute, and many poems that came out of a particular type of mood, this mood of detachment that we see in one of his most beautiful poems, My Play Is Done. And then Angels Unaware, we see his mood of this feeling of grace, the grace that comes from all of the misfortune that we have to go through in life. So all of these different attitudes we see. His beautiful poems of sympathy and love that he wrote on the passing away of some of his dear friends and disciples, Goodwin, the Maharaj of Khetri, and some of his poems which were really instructions and teachings which he wrote to Nivedita. So all of these show this tremendous versatility of Swamiji, the many-sided genius of Swamiji, and reveal aspects of his personality and his teachings that we don't get otherwise, that perhaps can only be revealed through poetry. And the best example that we have of even this tremendous experience of the vision or realization of the Divine Mother captured in poetry in his wonderful Kali the Mother. So this is Swamiji. If we didn't have enough reason already to stand in awe of Swamiji for his spirituality, for his lectures and his teachings and everything, this is one more reason, Swamiji as poet. Thank you. Let's sit for a few minutes.
Tamaso ma dhutir gamaya Maritya rama maritam gamaya Bhavira virmayeti Rudrayate dakshanam mukham Tenamam pahi nityam Om shanti 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 Harihi om tatsa. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all.